Welcome, Matt. We'll get started here in just a moment. Throwing out a few tweets, and we'll begin here in just a bit. Welcome everybody who is just coming in. I see Matt, I see Dodo. I see who else is in here. Nathaniel. Christine will be here in just a moment. She is finishing a tattoo again. Some reason she feels like she can't like rush a tattoo. I don't know what her deal is, but she'll be in here in a moment. I've still got a few more little groups I want to send something to. Oh, here's Christine. She's probably just going to jump in here for a second. And I've got a few more tweets I'm going to send out, and we will get started. And Christine could probably listen as she finishes up that last tattoo. So just a moment, and we will begin. All right. Welcome, everybody who is in here. It is the Golden Hour Book Club, and this is where every Monday and Wednesday night we all gather in here and we read. If you're like me, you had a passion for reading growing up, and I think that's a lot of us in here. You had a passion for reading growing up, and then something happened along the way, whether you had children, you got in a relationship, you went to college, you got introduced to mobile devices, and for whatever reason, you stopped reading. And if you're like me, you kind of mourn that time in your life whenever you read all the time. Because for me, I felt like that was like some of the smartest times in my life whenever I was reading often. So Christine, she one time had texted me and said, like, we need to start a book club and kind of a Twitter Spaces-based book club. And that's exactly what we did. I said, okay, I've got a really good one called Bitcoin Billionaires. It kind of gives the story of the Winklevoss twins and, you know, what happened after their lawsuit with Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. And we did that all through January. We kind of finished that, or all through December. And in the beginning of January, we finished that up. And then it was, well, what's the next book we're going to do? A lot of our audience is trading-based, and are people that either trade NFTs or crypto or stocks or options. And so over and over suggested to us was this book called Trading in the Zone by Mark Douglas. And you can find all kinds, hundreds, maybe even thousands of books that are based on trading systems of, oh, you're going to buy when it's above this moving average, or you're going to sell whenever it's oversold on, or you're going to sell whenever it's overbought on RSI or something like that. You can find those all over. Those are a dime a dozen. But this Trading in the Zone book really hones in on the mental side of trading. And that was a little different. And it came separately, independently to Christine and to me, where people would come to me saying, like, you really need to do this Trading in the Zone book. Christine heard the exact same thing. You really need to do this Trading in the Zone book. Do that for your next book club book. So we listened. We figured, like, hey, let's try that. And that's what we've done so far. We've done this for 2 weeks now, and we are through, I believe last Wednesday, we finished chapter 4 of Trading in the Zone. And it has been freaking amazing. I mean, it's been really good for me. I've read several books on trading. I really liked Michael Covell and Trend Following. I always thought that was an interesting take on how to trade. But this really got into the mental aspect of it and how we're really always trying to avoid emotional pain, right? So it mentioned last week, if you were a baby or a little boy or a little girl, you got a toy taken away from you. You had that emotional pain because that toy got taken away from you. Maybe the parent or parental figure had a reason for taking it away, but it caused you emotional pain. We all have a different makeup of how tolerant we are of emotional pain because of how we were brought up. And so because of that, it said that we're all different traders mentally, because we all have a different way that we can, you know, deal with the emotional pain that comes with trading. So that's what, that's a very quick one through four, chapter one through four, just summary right there. The way this is going to work is it is a live reading. I'm about to start chapter five here in just a moment. We'll jump right into it. But I want to remind everybody that it is a live reading, and that's not an audiobook. I will do my best to make it sound like an audiobook, but you know, I think I have the voice for it. But the thing is with a live reading is I'm going to mispronounce some things. I'm going to fumble over my words. An audiobook is edited, and you're going to get a little bit of what you would expect with a live reading, kind of like a live concert. It's going to sound a little bit different than what you hear on the album, right? So this is going to be a live reading. After chapter five, and possibly chapter six, I'm not sure if we're doing both chapters or not, but we'll see. After those, we will have a book club discussion. And this is where you can come up here to the stage, and I want to hear from you. I really do. A lot of times, Christine and I will kind of lead that conversation of saying like, oh, I really felt what Mark Douglas was saying right here. But I'm kind of tired of hearing myself speak at that point. And I always want to hear Christine speak, but I really want to hear from you guys in the audience. So if you've got some stories to tell, to be able to say like, hey, that book really kind of pierced me to the soul, and I think it's talking directly to me, and here's why. I'd love to hear that story. So come up here in the end. One thing I don't have for you this week that I normally have is a POAP. A lot of times, if you're not even familiar with what a POAP is, that's a proof of attendance protocol, something on blockchain, almost like an NFT that you can prove that you actually were in here. I don't have that this week. Why? Because last week I did it and only two people minted it and I was one of them. So I'm taking it. It's just not something that's really wanted. And that's okay. That's okay if you guys don't want a POAP. I'm just glad that you are in here. One last request that I will have from you is in the lower right-hand corner of the phone. You'll see the little speech bubble. Hit that, share, retweet that little tweet, share this room, get the most people in here, because we do want everybody to know about this and to know about the contents of this book so they can be the best trader they possibly can be. Maybe they've got a great system, but their mental game is absolutely just garbage. And maybe that's you. Maybe your mental game is absolutely just garbage. And if that's you, then I want you to listen to this book and share it with somebody else that could also benefit from this. So chapter five tonight is called The Dynamics of Perception, How We Perceive Different Things. And I'm assuming it's going to be that, how do we perceive emotional pain, which is what the trading markets can bring us. So I'm going to start with chapter five. By the time I get through with that, Christine will be through with a beautiful tattoo, I have no doubt. And she can tell us about that, and then she'll lead the book club discussion afterwards. So without any more about me just flapping my jaws about this, let's get on into this in chapter five, The Dynamics of Perception. One of the primary objectives of this book is to teach you how to take the threat of pain out of market information. The market doesn't generate happy or painful information. From the market's perspective, it's all simply information. It may seem as if the market is causing you to feel the way you do at any given moment, but that's not the case. It's your own mental framework that determines how you perceive the information, how you feel. As a result, whether or not you were in the most conducive state of mind to spontaneously enter the flow and take advantage of whatever the market is offering. Professionals don't perceive anything about the markets as painful. Therefore, no threat exists for them. If there's no threat, there's nothing to defend against. As a result, there isn't any reason for the conscious or subconscious defense mechanisms to kick in. That's why professionals can see and do things that mystify everyone else. They're in the flow because they're perceiving an endless stream of opportunities. And when they're not in the flow, the very best of the best can recognize that fact and then compensate by either scaling back or even not trading at all. If your goal is to be able to trade like the professionals, you must be able to see the market from an objective perspective without distortion. You must be able to act without resistance or hesitation, but with the appropriate amount of positive restraint to counteract the negative effects of overconfidence or euphoria. In essence, your objective is to be able to create a unique state of mind, a trader's mentality. When you've accomplished this, everything else about your success as a trader will fall into place. To help you achieve that objective, I'm going to give you a way to redefine your relationship to market information so that there will be little or no potential to perceive any of it as threatening. By redefine, I mean to change your perspective and operate out of a mental framework that keeps you focused on the opportunities available instead of tapping you into emotional pain. Debugging your mental software. In other words, we want to get the bugs out of your mental software code and get our minds right. Doing this effectively will require an understanding of the nature of mental energy and how you can use that energy to change a perspective that is generating an unwanted, negative, emotional response to market information. There's much to learn, but I think you will be amazed at how some simple changes can make a huge difference in your trading results. The process of trading starts with perceiving an opportunity. Without the perception of an opportunity, we wouldn't have a reason to trade. So I think it is only fitting that we start our examination of mental energy by breaking down the process of perception. What are the underlying dynamics of perception? What factors determine how we perceive information or what we perceive in relationship to what is available? How is perception connected with what we experience at any given moment? Probably the easiest way to understand the dynamics of perception and answer these questions is to think of everything, and I do mean everything, that exists in, on, and around this planet as a collection of forces. Forces that generate information about the properties, characteristics, and traits that make them uniquely what they are. Everything that exists outside of our bodies, all plants and all categories of life, all planetary phenomena in the form of weather conditions, earthquakes, and volcanic eruptions, all active in inert physical matter, and all non-corporeal phenomena such as light, sound waves, microwaves, and radiation generates information about the nature of its existence. The information has the potential to act as a force on one or five physical senses. Before I go any further, notice that I use the verb generate in an all-inclusive way, implying that everything is an active state of expression, including inanimate objects. To illustrate why I do that, let's look at something as simple as a rock. It's an inanimate object, composed of unique atoms and molecules expressing themselves as a rock. I can use the action verb expressing because the atoms and molecules that make up the rock are in constant motion. So even though the rock doesn't appear to be active, except in the most abstract sense, it has the characteristics and properties that will act as forces on our senses, causing us to experience and make distinctions about the nature of its existence. For example, a rock has texture, and that texture acts as a force on our sense of touch if we run our fingers across the rock's surface. A rock has shape and color, which act as a force on our vision. The rock takes up space that no other object can occupy, so that we see it instead of an empty space or some other object. A rock can also have an odor that acts as a force on our sense of smell, our taste like something, although I haven't licked any rocks lately to find out. When we encounter anything in the environment that expresses its properties and characteristics, an exchange of energy takes place. Energy from the outside, in the form of whatever is expressing itself, gets transformed by our nervous system into electrical impulses and then gets stored in our inner mental environment. To be more specific, whatever we are seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, or feeling through our senses gets transformed into electrical impulses of energy and stored in our mental environment as a memory and or distinction about the nature of the way things exist. I think all of this is fairly self-evident to most people, but there are some profound implications here that aren't self-evident, and we typically take them completely for granted. First of all, there's a cause and effect relationship that exists between ourselves and everything else that exists in the external environment. As a result, our encounters with external forces create what I'm going to call energy structures inside our minds. The memories, distinctions, and ultimately the beliefs we acquire throughout our lives exist in our mental environment in the form of structured energy. Structured energy is an abstract concept. You might be asking yourself, but ask yourself, in what other form could these mental components exist? Here's what we know for sure. Anything composed of atoms and molecules takes up space and therefore can be observed. If memories, distinctions, and beliefs existed in some physical form, then we should be able to observe them. To my knowledge, no such observations have been made. The scientific community has dissected brain tissue, both living and dead, examined it at the level of the individual atom, mapped various regions of the brain in terms of their functions, but nobody, as of yet, has observed a memory, a distinction, or belief in its natural form. By in its natural form, I mean that although a scientist can observe the individual brain cells that contain certain memories, he can't experience those memories firsthand. He can only experience them if the person to whom the memories belong is alive and chooses and expresses them in some way. If memories, distinctions, and beliefs don't exist as physical matter, then there really isn't any alternative way for them to exist except as some form of energy. If this is in fact the case, can this energy take on a specific shape? Can it be structured in a way that reflects the external forces that caused it to come into existence? Most definitely. Is there anything in the environment that is analogous to energy having shape or a specific structure? Yes. Let me give you several examples. Thoughts are energy. Because you think in a language, your thoughts are structured by the limitations and rules that govern the particular language in which you think. When you express those thoughts aloud, you create sound waves, which are a form of energy. The sound waves created by the interaction of your vocal cords and tongue are structured by the content of your message. Microwaves are energy. Many phone calls are relayed by microwaves, which means that microwave energy has to be structured in a way that reflects the message it is carrying. Laser light is energy, and if you've ever witnessed a demonstration of how a laser light show or laser art, what you've seen is pure energy taking shape that reflects the creative desires of the artists. All of these are good examples of how energy can take shape, form, and structure. Of course, there are many more, but there is one more example that illustrates the point in the most graphic way. At the most fundamental level, what are dreams? I am not asking you what dreams mean or what you think their purpose is, but rather, what are they? What are their properties? If we assume that dreams take place within the confines of our skulls, then we can't be composed of atoms and molecules because there wouldn't be enough space for all the things that exist and take place in our dreams. Dream experiences seem to have the same proportions and dimensions as the things we perceive when we are awake and experiencing life through our five senses. The only way this could be possible is if dreams were a form of structured energy. Because energy can take on any size or dimension, but in doing so, doesn't actually take up any space. Now, if it hasn't already occurred to you, there's something here that's really profound. If the memories, distinctions, and beliefs we've acquired as a result of our encounters with the external environment represent what we've learned about the environment and how it works, and if these memories, distinctions, and beliefs exist in our mental environment as energy, and if energy doesn't take up any space, then it could also be said that we have an unlimited capacity for learning. Well, not only do I think it could be said, I'm saying it. Consider the development of human consciousness and what we've learned collectively, as well as what the typical individual needs to know to function effectively compared to just 100 years ago. There is absolutely nothing to indicate that we don't have an unlimited capacity to learn. The difference between what we are aware of now and what we can do of as a result of the expanded awareness would boggle the mind to anyone living 100 years ago. Perception and learning. However, we must be careful not to equate storage capacity with learning capacity. Learning and becoming aware of what is available to be learned is not just a function of storage capacity. If it were, then what would stop us from knowing everything? And if we knew everything, then what would stop us from perceiving every possible characteristic, property, or trait of everything that is expressing itself at any given moment? What stops us now? These questions get to the very heart of why you have to understand that mental components, like memories, distinctions, and beliefs, exist as energy. Anything that is energy has the potential to act as a force expressing its form, and that is exactly what our memories, distinctions, and beliefs do. They act as a force on our senses from the inside, expressing their form and content, and in the process of doing so, they have a profoundly limiting effect on the information as we perceive in any given moment, making much of the information that is available from the environment's perspective and the possibilities inherent within that information, literally invisible. I'm saying here that in any given moment, the environment is generating an enormous amount of information about its properties, characteristics, and traits. Some of that information is beyond the physiological range of our senses. For example, our eyes can't see every wavelength of light, nor can our ears hear every frequency of sound the environment produces. So there's definitely a range of information that is beyond the physiological capabilities of our senses. What about the rest of the information the environment is generating about itself? Do we see, hear, taste, smell, or feel through every sense, through every possible distinction, trait, and characteristic being expressed by everything that is within the physiological range of our senses? Absolutely not. The energy that's inside of us will categorically limit and block our awareness of much of this information by working through the same sensory mechanism the external environment works through. Now, if you take a moment and think about it, some of what I said just should be self-evident. For example, there are many ways in which the external environment can express itself that we don't perceive simply because we haven't learned about them yet. This is easy to illustrate. Think back to the first time you ever looked at a price chart. What did you see? Exactly what did you perceive? With no previous exposure, I'm sure. Like everyone else, you saw a bunch of lines that had no meaning. Now, if you're like most traders, when you look at a price chart, you see characteristics, traits, and behavior patterns that represent the collective actions of all traders who participated in those particular trades. Initially, the chart represented undifferentiated information. Undifferentiated information usually creates a state of confusion, and that's probably what you experienced when you first encountered a chart. Gradually, however, you learned to make distinctions about that information, such as trends, trend lines, consolidations, support and resistance, retracements, or significant relationships between volume and open interest in price action, just to name a few. You learned that each of these distinctions in market behavior represented an opportunity to fulfill some personal need, goal, or desire. Each distinction now had a meaning and some relative degree of significance or importance attached to it. Now, I want you to use your imagination and pretend that I just set before you the very first price chart you ever saw. Would there be a difference between what you see now and what you saw then? Absolutely. Instead of a bunch of undifferentiated lines, you would see everything you learned about those lines between then and now. In other words, you would see all the distinctions that you've learned to make, as well as all the opportunities those distinctions represent. Yet, everything you can see as you look at that chart now existed then, and furthermore, was available to be perceived. What's the difference? The structured energy that's inside of you now, the knowledge you have gained, acts as a force on your eyes, causing you to recognize the various distinctions that you've learned about. Since that energy wasn't there the first time you looked at the chart, all the opportunities that you see were there, but at the same time, they were invisible to you. Furthermore, unless you learn to make every possible distinction based on every possible relationship between the variables in that chart, what you haven't learned yet is still invisible. Most of us have no concept of the extent of which we are continually surrounded by the invisible opportunities inherent in the information we're exposed to. More often than not, we never learn about these opportunities, and as a result, they remain invisible. The problem, of course, is that we're completely new or unique situation, or we're operating out of an attitude of genuine openness. We won't perceive something that we haven't learned about yet. To learn about something, we have to be able to experience it in some way. So what we have here is a closed loop that prevents us from learning. Perpetual closed loop exists in all of us because there are natural functions of the way mental energy expresses itself in our senses. Everyone has heard the expression, people see what they want to see. I would put it a little differently. People see what they've learned to see, and everything else is invisible until they learn how to counteract that energy that blocks their awareness of whatever is unlearned and waiting to be discovered. To illustrate this concept and make it even clearer, I'm going to give you another example, one that demonstrates how mental energy can affect how we perceive and experience the environment in a way that actually reverses the cause and effect relationship. Let's look at a very young child's first encounter with a dog. Because it's a first-time experience, the child's mental environment is a clean slate, so to speak, with respect to dogs. He won't have any memories and certainly no distinctions about a dog's nature. Therefore, up to the moment of his first encounter, from the child's perspective, dogs don't exist. Of course, from the environment's perspective, dogs do exist, and they have the potential to act as a force on the child's senses to create an experience. In other words, dogs expressing their nature can act as a cause to produce an effect inside the child's mental environment. What kind of effect are dogs capable of producing? Well, dogs have a range of expression. By range of expression, I mean dogs can behave in a number of ways towards humans. They can be friendly, loving, protective, fun to play with. They can be hostile, though, mean, and even dangerous, just to name a few of the many behaviors they're capable of. All of these traits can be observed, experienced, and learned about. When the child sees the dog for the first time, there's absolutely nothing in his mental environment to tell him what he is dealing with. Unfamiliar, unknown, and unclassified environmental information can generate a sense of curiosity. When we want to find out more about what we're experiencing, or it can generate a state of confusion, which can easily turn into fear if we can't place the information into an understandable or meaningful organizational framework or context. In our example, the child's sense of curiosity kicks in and he rushes to the dog to get more sensory experience. Notice how children are literally compelled to thrust themselves into a situation they know nothing about. However, in this example, the environmental forces at hand do not react favorably to the child's advances. The dog the child is interested in is either inherently mean or having a bad day. In any case, as soon as the child gets close enough, the dog bites him. The attack is so severe that the dog has to be pulled off of the child. This kind of unfortunate experience is certainly not typical, but it's not that uncommon either, and I chose to say it for two reasons. First and foremost, people can relate in some way, either from their own direct experience or through the experience of someone they know. Second, as we analyze the underlying dynamics of this experience from an energy perspective, we're going to learn about, one, how our minds are designed to think, and two, process information. Three, how these processes affect what we experience, and four, our ability to recognize new possibilities. I know this may seem like a lot of insight from just one example, but the principles involved apply to the dynamics beneath virtually all learning. As a result of being physically and emotionally traumatized, the little boy in our example now has a memory, and one distinction about the way dogs can express themselves. If the boy's ability to remember his experiences is normal, he can store this incident in a way that represents all of the senses the experience had an impact on. For example, the attack can be stored as mental images based on what he saw, as well as mental sounds representing on what he heard, and so on. Memories representing the other three senses will work the same way. However, the kind of sensory data in his memory is not as important as the kind of energy the sensory data represents. We basically have two kinds of mental energy: positively charged energy, which we call love, confidence, happiness, joy, satisfaction, excitement, and enthusiasm, to name a few of the pleasant ways we can feel, and negatively charged energy, representing fear, terror, dissatisfaction, betrayal, regret, anger, confusion, anxiety, stress, and frustration, all representing what is commonly referred to as emotional pain. Because the boy's first experience with the dog was intensely painful, we can assume that regardless of what senses were affected, all of his memories of this experience will be in a painful, unpleasant feeling, negative energy. Now, what effect will this negatively charged mental energy have on his perception and behavior if and when he encounters another dog? The answer is so obvious that it may seem ridiculous to even ask, but the underlying implications are not obvious, so bear with me. Clearly, the moment he comes into contact with another dog, he will experience fear. Notice I use the word another to describe the next dog he has any contact with. What I want to point out is that any dog can cause the boy to feel fear, and not just the same one that actually attacked him. It won't make a bit of difference if the dog he next comes into contact with is the friendliest dog in the world, one whose nature is only to express playfulness and love. The child will still be afraid, and furthermore, his fear could quickly turn to unrestrained terror, especially if the second dog, seeing a child is wanting to play, attempts to approach him. Each of us has at one time or another witnessed a situation in which someone was experiencing fear, when, from our perspective, there wasn't the least bit of danger or threat. Although we may not have said it, we probably thought to ourselves that this person was just being irrational. If we tried to point out why there was no need to be afraid, we probably would found their words had little, if any, impact. We could easily think about the same thing about the boy in our example, that he's just being irrational, because it's clear from our perspective that other possibilities exist that one of his in his mind has focused on. But is his fear any less rational then? Let's say your fear or hesitation about putting on the next trade when your last trade was a loser. Using the same logic, a top trader would say that your fear is irrational because this now moment opportunity has absolutely nothing to do with your last trade. Each trade is simply an edge with a probable outcome and statistically independent of every other trade. If you believe otherwise, then I can see why you're afraid, but I can assure you that your fears are completely unfounded. Perception and risk. As you can see, one person's perception of risk can easily be perceived as irrational thinking by another. Risk is relative, but to the person who perceives it in the moment, it seems absolute and beyond question. When the child encountered his first dog, he was bubbling with excitement and curiosity. What is it about the way our minds think and process information that could automatically flip the boy into a state of fear the next time he encounters a dog, even if it's months or years later? If we look at fear as a natural mechanism warning us of threatening conditions, then what is it about the way our minds function that would automatically tell the boy that the next encounter with a dog is something to be afraid of? What happened to the boy's natural sense of curiosity? There is surely more to learn about the nature of dogs in this one experience that has taught him, especially in light of the fact that our minds seem to have an unlimited capacity for learning. And why would it be virtually impossible to talk the boy out of his fear? The power of association. As complex as these questions may seem at first glance, most of them can be answered quite easily. I'm sure many of you already know the answer. Our minds have an inherent design characteristic that causes us to associate and link anything that exists in the external environment that is similar in quality, characteristics, properties, or traits to anything that already exists in our mental environment as a memory or distinction. In other words, in the example of the child being afraid of dogs, the second dog, or any dog he encounters thereafter, doesn't have to be the dog that attacked in order for him to experience emotional pain. There just has to be enough of a likeness or similarity for his mind to make a connection between the two. This natural tendency for our minds to associate is an unconscious mental function that occurs automatically. It's not something we have to think about or make a decision about. An unconscious mental function would be analogous to an involuntary physical function such as a heartbeat. Just as we don't have to consciously think about the process of making our hearts beat, we don't have to think about linking experiences and our feelings about them. It's simply a natural function of the way our minds process information. And like a heartbeat, it's a function that has a profound effect on the way we experience our lives. I'd like you to try and visualize the two-way flow of energy that reverses the cause and effect relationship that will make it difficult, if not impossible, for the boy to perceive any other possibilities from the one that's in his mind. To help you, I'm going to break this process down into its smallest parts and go through what happens step by step. All of this may seem a bit abstract, but understanding this process...
Just happy to talk with you.
Sorry, y'all. That was my Google Home. All of this may seem a bit abstract, but understanding this process plays a big part in unlocking your potential to achieve consistent success as a big trader. First, let's get right down to the basics. There's structured energy on the outside of the boy and structured energy on the inside of the boy. The outside energy is positively charged in the form of a friendly dog that wants to express itself by playing. The inside energy is negatively charged memory in the form of mental images and sounds that represents the boy's first experience with a dog. Both the inside and the outside of energy have the potential to make themselves felt on the boy's senses and, as a result, create two different kinds of situations for him to experience. The outside energy has the potential to act as a force on the boy in a way that he could find very enjoyable. This particular dog expresses behavior characteristics like playfulness, friendliness, and even love. But keep in mind that these characteristics that the child still has not experienced in a dog. So, from his perspective, they don't exist. Just as in the price chart example I presented earlier, the child won't be able to perceive what he hasn't yet learned about unless he is in a state of mind that is conducive to learning. The inside energy also has the potential and is just waiting, so to speak, to express itself, but it will act on the boy's eyes and ears in a way that causes him to feel threatened. This, in turn, will create an experience of emotional pain, fear, and possibly even terror. From the way I've set this up, it may seem as if the boy has a choice between experiencing fun or experiencing fear, but that's really not the case, at least not in the moment. Of the two possibilities that exist in this situation, he will undoubtedly experience the pain and fear instead of the fun, and this is true for several reasons. First, as I've already indicated, our minds are wired to be automatically and instantaneously associate and link information that has similar characteristics, properties, and traits. What's outside of the child in the form of a dog looks and sounds similar to the one that's in his mind. However, the degree of similarity that is necessary for his mind to link the two is an unknown variable, meaning I don't know the mental mechanism that determines how much or how little similarities is required for our minds to associate and link two or more sets of information. Since everyone's mind functions in a similar way, but at the same time is unique, I would assume there is a range of tolerance for similarity or dissimilarity, and each of us has a unique capacity somewhere within that range. Here's what we do know. As this next dog comes into contact with the boy's eyes or ears, if there is enough similarity between the way it looks and or sounds and the dog that's embedded in his memory, then his mind will automatically connect the two. This connection, in turn, will cause the negatively charged energy in his memory to be released throughout his body, causing him to be overcome with a very uncomfortable sense or foreboding of terror. The degree of discomfort or emotional pain that he experiences will be equivalent to the degree of trauma that he suffered as a result of his first encounter with a dog. What happens next is what psychologists call a projection. I'm going to refer to it simply as another instantaneous association that makes the reality of the situation from the boy's perspective seem like the absolute, unquestionable truth. The boy's body is now filled with negatively charged energy. At the same time, he is in sensory contact with the dog. Next, his mind associates whatever sensory information his eyes or ears perceive with the painful energy he's experiencing inside himself, which makes it seem as if the source of his pain and fear is the dog he is seeing or hearing in that moment. Psychologists call the dynamics of what I just described a projection because, in a sense, the boy is projecting the pain he is experiencing in the moment onto the dog. The painful energy that gets reflected back to him so that he perceives a dog that is threatening, painful, and dangerous. This process makes the second dog identical in character, properties, and traits to the one that is in the boy's memory bank, even though the information the second dog is generating about its behavior is not identical or even similar to the behavior of the dog that actually attacked the boy. Since the two dogs, the one in the boy's mind, the one outside the boy's mind, actually feel the same, it's extremely unlikely the boy will be able to make any type of distinctions in the second dog's behavior that would suggest to him that it is any different than the one in his mind. So, instead of perceiving this next encounter with the dog as an opportunity to experiencing something new about the nature of dogs, he perceives a threatening and dangerous dog. Now, if you think about it for a moment, what is it about this process that would indicate to the boy that his experience of the situation was not the absolute, unquestionable truth? Certainly the pain and fear that he experienced in his body was the absolute truth, but what about the possibilities that he perceived? Were they true? From our perspective, they weren't. However, from the boy's perspective, how could they be anything but the true reality of the situation? What alternatives did he have? First, he can't perceive possibilities that he hasn't yet learned about, and yet it is extremely difficult to learn anything new if you're afraid, because, as you well already know, fear is a very debilitating form of energy. It causes us to withdraw, to get ready to protect ourselves, to run, and to narrow our focus of attention, all of which makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to open ourselves in a way that allows us to learn something new. Second, as I have already indicated, as far as the boy is concerned, the dog is the source of his pain, and in a sense, this is true. The second dog did cause him to tap into the pain that was already in his mind, but it was not the true source of that pain. This was positively charged dog that got connected to the boy's negatively charged energy by an automatic, involuntary mental process functioning at speeds faster than it takes to blink an eye, a process that the boy has absolutely no awareness of. So as far as he's concerned, why would he be afraid if what he perceived about the dog wasn't the absolute truth? As you can see, it wouldn't make any difference of how the dog was acting or what someone might say to the contrary about why the boy shouldn't be afraid, because he will perceive whatever information the dog is generating about itself, regardless of how positive, from a negative perspective. He will not have the slightest notion that his experience of pain, fear, and terror was completely self-generated. Now, if it's possible for the boy to self-generate his own pain, in terror, and at the same time, be firmly convinced that his negative experience was coming from the environment, is it also possible for traitors to self-generate their own experiences of fear and emotional pain as they interact with market information and be thoroughly convinced that their pain and fear was completely justified by the circumstances? The underlying psychological dynamics work in exactly the same way. One of your basic objectives as a traitor is to perceive the opportunities available, not the threat of pain. To learn how to stay focused on the opportunities, you need to know and understand, in no uncertain terms, the source of the threat. It's not the market. The market generates information about its potential to move from a neutral perspective. At the same time, it provides you, the observer, with an unending stream of opportunities to do something on your own behalf. If what you perceive at any given moment causes you to fear, ask yourself this question: is the information inherently threatening, or are you simply experiencing the effect of your own state of mind reflected back to you, as in the above illustration? I know this is a difficult concept to accept, so I'll give you another example to illustrate the point. Let's set up a scenario where your last two or three trades were all losers. You're watching the market, and the variables you use to indicate that an opportunity exists are now present. Instead of immediately executing the trade, you hesitate. The trade feels very risky, so risky, in fact, that you start questioning whether this is really a signal. As a result, you start gathering information to support why this trade probably won't work. This is information you normally wouldn't consider or pay attention to, and it's certainly not information that is part of the trading methodology. In the meantime, the market is moving. Unfortunately, it is moving away from your original entry point, the point at which you would have gotten into the trade if you hadn't hesitated. Now you are conflicted because you still want to get in. The thought of missing a winning trade is painful. At the same time, as the market moves away from your entry point, the dollar value of the risk to participate increases. The tug of war inside your mind intensifies. You don't want to miss out, but you don't want to get whipsawed either. In the end, you do nothing because you're paralyzed by the conflict. You justify your state of immobility by telling yourself that it's just too risky to chase the market, while you agonize over every tick the market moves in the direction of what would have been a nice winning trade. If this scenario sounds familiar, I want you to ask yourself whether, at the moment you hesitated, were you perceiving what the market was making available or perceiving what was in your mind reflected back to you? The market gave you a signal, but you didn't perceive the signal from an objective or positive perspective. You didn't see it as an opportunity to experience the positive feeling you would get from winning or making money, but that's exactly what the market was making available to you. Think about this for a moment. If I changed the scenario so that the last two or three trades were winners instead of losers, would you have perceived the signal any differently? Would you have perceived it to be more of an opportunity to win than you did in the first scenario? If you were coming off three winners in a row, would you have hesitated to put that trade on? Very unlikely. In fact, if you're like most traders, you probably would have been giving very strong consideration to loading up, putting a position much larger than your normal size. In each situation, the market generated the same signal, but your state of mind was negative and fear-based in the first scenario, and that caused you to focus on the possibility of failure, which in turn caused you to hesitate. In the second scenario, you hardly perceived any risk at all. You may have thought that the market was making a dream come true. That, in turn, would make it easy, if not compelling, to financially overcommit yourself. If you can accept the fact that the market doesn't generate positively or negatively charged information as an inherent characteristic on the way it expresses itself, then the only other way that information can take on a positive or negative charge is in your mind, and that is a function of the way the information is processed. In other words, the market doesn't cause you to focus on failure and pain or on winning and pleasure. What causes the information to take on a positive or negative quality is the same unconscious mental process that caused the boy to perceive the second dog as threatening and dangerous, when all the dog was offering was playfulness and friendship. Our minds constantly associate what's outside of us, information, with something that's already in our mind, what we know, making it seem as if the outside circumstances and the memory, distinction, or belief these circumstances are associated with are the exact same. As a result, in the first scenario, if you were coming off two or three losing trades, the next signal the market gives you an opportunity to present will feel overly risky. Your mind is automatically and unconsciously linking the now moment with your most recent trading experiences. The link taps you into the pain of losing, creating a fearful state of mind and causing you to perceive the information you're exposed to in that moment from a negative perspective. It seems as if the market is expressing threatening information. So, of course, your hesitation is justified. In the second scenario, the same process causes you to perceive the situation from an overly positive perspective because you were coming off three winners in a row. The association between the now moment and the elation of the last three trades creates an overly positive or euphoric state of mind, making it seem as if the market is offering you a riskless opportunity. Of course, this justifies overcommitting yourself. In Chapter 1, I said that many of the mental patterns that cause traders to lose and make errors are so self-evident and deeply ingrained that it would never occur to us that the reason we aren't consistently successful is because of the way we think. Understanding, becoming consciously aware of, and then learning how to circumvent the mind's natural propensity to associate is a big part of achieving that consistency. developing and maintaining a state of mind that perceives the opportunity flow of the market without the threat of the pain or the problems caused by overconfidence will require that you take conscious control of the association process. And that is chapter 5. Christine, are you there? Did you finish up that? Very, very good. Very, very good. What point were you able to join in?
So I wasn't able to hear much because my client was talking. So I was hoping for a cliff note.
Oh, I can definitely give a cliff's notes. And by the way, anybody that's in the audience that was able to listen to the whole thing, or even if you just listened to a bit of it and something in it kind of resonated with you, or you'd like to give a story about your trading, come up and we'll get you up here and I'd love to hear what you have to say. But I'll give a little cliff's notes to Christine here and maybe that'll, you know, jar your memory of something. But okay, so are you ready? Because I'm gonna give a review of this chapter, and it's not all gonna be glowing. Is that okay?
I'm ready.
Okay. Because this is a book club, right? I don't have to have glowing review over every chapter I read. So it started off. First of all, I feel like a little bit of this could have been put on the editing room floor. Okay, to use like a movie term, could have done a little bit of editing here, and I feel like it was a little lengthy. And said a few of the same things over and over. That's my first critique. Second critique, and this only goes by I am a man of science, okay? If any of you don't know, you may not be as familiar with me. In another life, I was a pharmacist. And so I have a doctorate degree in, you know, in something in medicine, and therefore I'm kind of a man of science. And so whenever he starts talking about this negative energy and this positive energy, and it's how our neurons and electrons are put together, and he compared it to the electrons of a rock and how all those electrons make it up to be where you can sense and touch. And I understand what he's trying to say. Everything that he is saying, I get what he's trying to say. He just lost me a little bit with all that negative and positive energy. It felt a little hokey to me. Felt a little, I don't know, what am I trying to say? Just wishy-washy. So that's my first thought. But he compared everything that we perceive as positive or negative energy. And he went back and back to an analogy, which I thought was a really good analogy. He mentioned the first time a little boy comes in contact with a dog. And let's say it was a mean dog, okay? Won't get into any breeds here because I know you guys get really serious whenever I mention like a bully breed or something. But let's just say it was, oh, just so I don't get any of you pit bull fanatics after me. Let's say it was a very nice Shih Tzu, okay? Beautiful Shih Tzu, comes up to the little boy and it bites him, and it bites him hard, leaves permanent scars on his arm where it bit, and it barked and it was really mean. And it said that little boy, from that point forward, whenever he sees any dog, maybe not even just a Shih Tzu, but any dog, he's going to have that ingrained fear in his mind because that's going to be absolutely true. Now, the next dog that he sees, the book said, that it could be completely the nicest, most loving dog you've ever seen. Literally just wants to lick him in the face and be his best friend. But to that baby, the association is already there between dogs and danger, and therefore he is fearful, making his second and third and fourth and 100th encounter with dogs, possibly for the rest of his life, a negative experience. And he's not open to learning new experiences because he's already been bit by this dog. And he went into this analogy several times, but I thought it was good because then he started making it like the trading analogy. And he said, imagine, you know, whenever you first saw a chart for the first time ever in your life, you saw a chart, you knew nothing about it. You knew not what a candlestick was. You didn't know what highs and lows. It was just kind of lines to you. You didn't know anything about it. But you started learning a little bit more about it. You learned what support and resistance were. You knew what a trend line was. You started learning some indicators. And now whenever you see a chart, it means something completely different to you than whenever you saw it the first time. The problem is, he said, is that if you start trading, you do start getting some negative emotional baggage as well. So whenever you start trading and let's say you just completely blow out your account, then you start having this negative emotion, much like that little boy had the negative emotion about the dog. And next time you see an opportunity, much like the new dog that came to the boy that just wanted to love, and in this case, this is a trade that just wants to love you and just wants to 100x your investment, just wants to lick you in the face as a trade, you're scared of it. And you say, I don't know, man. I think I'm out. And so because you're afraid and your perception of that trade is much like that that angry dog, you're out. You don't go in and you end up not taking the trade. And you know what happens. The trade goes off and it does 100x and you don't do anything. It then said, look at it the other side of things. Let's say instead, the first dog you saw was, he didn't actually say this, but I'm going to go ahead and flip it. Let's say the first dog you saw was overly nice, overly lick you in the face, right? And then you don't have like a healthy fear of dogs, of what, you know, what a dog could, that a dog could possibly turn on you. And it had the exact same thing with trading. Let's say just your first 10 trades out of the gate, or maybe you're just on a hot streak where you're trying a new system, right? You've got a new system. You're like, I'm going to use RSI and I'm going to use, you know, whatever indicator you want. And you do 10 trades in a row and it's just working everything you do. And you start thinking like, the markets are an absolute bank. They're just an ATM that I'm just going to draw out of. Well, what happens? Your emotional response is actually overly positive in this case, and you load up too much, and then you become overconfident, and you wipe out your account because of that. So what ultimately he was getting into is the perception of the market. If you already have that fear ingrained in you, and it's already ingrained, much like that little boy with the baby, then you're not going to be able to look at the market without having that fear affect your decisions. So here at the end, he was basically saying, if you are aware of it, right, you might be able to kind of dissociate those negative feelings that you already have ingrained in you, or overly positive feelings for that matter, that you have ingrained in you. If you're aware of it, you might be able to help yourself with that. But being aware of it is the first thing. That's all I got, Christine. That's the cliff notes of it.
I love it. It kind of sounds like it's very similar to chapter 4 as well, when he was comparing like the snake thing.
Yes, sorry. I was getting liquid for this.
It was very similar to the example with the snake, and then even though you knew that not every snake is venomous, you would still, like, if you had a bad experience, you would associate it with that one bad experience.
See, you're saying what I said in not so many words. He could have cut out a little bit of this chapter, but he's no longer with us, so I'm not gonna critique his chapter too long. Here's the thing.
In all due respect,
that's right. But here's the thing I do want to say, like, if anybody's, this is your first chapter to hear me speak on this, you know, to hear me read on here and hear my critique, this is probably, and Christine can verify, this is the first time I've critiqued this book. This is a great book. This is a really good book. I just think in this particular chapter, he just, I don't know, probably could have put in about half of what it was. But it is a good chapter. And like I said, I do understand what he's trying to say. Even though we got into all this positive and negative energy, kind of some, I don't know, it's like some new wave kind of stuff. And he got into all that. I understood what he was trying to say. And that's basically just how we perceive the market. So Christine, you've been doing a lot of options trading, and I know I've met you during kind of the NFT bull run. So have you ever found yourself on either side of that paradigm, where either A, you're feeling too confident, or B, you're feeling very fearful of the markets? Do you recall ever feeling like either of those two emotions?
Yeah, both. Absolutely. Both emotions. And I think that's like what I'm trying to rid of, because we know, like, as we have evolved into better traders, or we should be evolving into better traders, that it needs to be very emotionless, right? So, but I have felt both those very much, and then it messes you up.
Absolutely. And I've felt both of them very much as well. I like to feel the overconfident one, but man, I've really made that mistake before. Well, I'll try some new system out, and I wonder how many good systems I've thrown away because of this very move, right? Where I'm like, okay, I'm going to try these indicators, and it works. And it works really, really well. And then I'm like, this is working so well, I should double my position for everything that I'm doing. I should double it. Just a double? Big deal. Just a double. Okay, and I double it. And maybe even it works. Maybe even the doubling works. And then I'm thinking, gosh, I mean, if I'm doubling position, just leaving money here. I mean, I'm wasting money if I'm not actually tripling the position, my original position, or maybe I'll even double my doubled position. Maybe I'll quadruple the original position. And then I blow out an account just because I got overly confident and did not have a healthy fear of the market. And I will bet over the years I've thrown away some decent systems because of that, just because of I just got in my own way. Then I've definitely had the other side of things where, you know how it is, where sometimes you just start out a system and it just goes bad the first few times. Call it bad luck or whatever. It just goes bad the first few times. And I've probably thrown away some different systems as well, just saying like, this sucks. And I start getting fearful of ever doing what it says. And then one point I wanted to make as I was reading that I thought about, Christine, I don't know what system you use or anything like that, but do you look over some sort of back test when you decide how you're going to trade? Do you look over the last, like, I don't know, what would the last 20 trades have looked like on the chart? Do you look left very often?
I do look left quite often. And then I always wonder, because everyone has their own strategies, but there's a few traders that don't, and they kind of just go on momentum and don't really look back. But I do. I use like a 200, and I'll go back sometimes a couple months, even like a year, like just to like really assess, yeah, like if there is any patterns that I recognize or can be applied to that day.
Yeah, absolutely. And so here's the thing, on the people you say, you know, some traders that don't look left, I will bet they originally did, but they've actually done some of the things that's talked about in this book where their fear is not as big of a deal, and they feel confident in their system. And once you feel confident in something and you're just executing the trades, you probably don't need to look left very often. You probably just go forward, just make the trades and just make them happen. But what I was going to suggest about looking left for those of you that are like trying out different strategies and things like that is we don't take into account whenever we look left and look at a historical, what would the system have done historically, we don't take this mental part of the game at all. We look at it and we say, oh, well, you know, here was the indicator. The conditions were right. It told me to buy right here. And if I would have bought right here, then I would have done really well. And it told me to get out right here and I would have gotten out. And it doesn't take into the fact that, oh yeah, there was four losing trades right before that. And by the time you get to that fifth trade that was a big winner, you were scared, right? And you didn't want to take that fifth trade because you were so scared of the fourth trades. And I don't think we take any of that in consideration whenever we're backtesting. We merely look at what the best case scenario was, where we're taking every trade every time the indicator says to do so. And I don't know, that kind of something that I need to start thinking about as I'm looking back, because I'm looking back as a perfect trader and I'm going forward as an imperfect trader.
Yeah, I agree. And I look forward to that day where I don't have to, you know, because it's what you're saying, like us looking left or whatever can be us just nervous. I don't know. I don't even know, but I feel like I'm uncertain and I want to try to make sure that I can execute like a excellent trade, you know, and I feel like looking left will help me, but obviously it's not even.
But I'm not suggesting thing. Look left. Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't look left. I'm just suggesting whenever you do backtest, you just got to remember that, you know, just because whenever there's four bad trades in a row, are you going to have the fortitude? And it kind of might be a reminder of like, hey, I'm backtesting here. There's four bad trades in a row, but in the end, this system is profitable on the whole if you are backtesting like that. To me, if you do that and you feel really good about it, then it gives you a little more confidence whenever you are going forward with it of, damn, this sucks that I lost four in a row, you know, in real-time trades, actual trades, not backtesting, but real trades. And it might give you some confidence. It'll be like, hey, no fear. I'm not going to be like the kid that got bit by the dog. I'm just going to have no fear and I'm going to take the fifth trade. And if it loses, I've got confidence in the system. Do you know? And that's what it gets down to: is are you confident in your probabilities that you've got put before you?
It's so hard once like there's four bad trades in a row where you're like, I'm confident that you know this is fine and I'm going to execute a good trade. I feel like after the third bad trade, I start doubting like everything, and I try to start all over again and try to doubt every strategy I know. I'm like, I must not be doing, but I could do like 2 weeks straight where I'm like, wow, Like, I'm doing good. And then it takes, you know, three bad trades in a row. And I'm like, I don't know anything.
I'm just an idiot. Well, you know, the thing that I think you probably have to keep in mind is here lately, you've been doing more options, which are, I mean, they're a derivative. They're very leveraged, right? Like a small chart movement can make a big impact to your bottom line, right? Both positive and negative. So do you think for those in the crowd here that are doing something that's heavily leveraged, whether doing Forex, which can be pretty heavily leveraged, you can do that with crypto as well, and certainly with options, don't you feel like all of these emotions that you feel, both good and bad, are even more magnified with options?
Yes.
Yeah, because you're like, hell yeah, 1,000x. You know, you start getting really excited, and all of a sudden you're like, oh no, this thing's going to expire worthless. And that's bad too. Let me just tell you, Christine, just putting all cards on the table here, I have found that very difficult with options so far. Of just the it's so much different for me than trading like crypto or something like that. However, would like to announce I've opened back up into trading with crypto, trying to use some of the principles of trading in the zone on here.
And how's
it's
that?
Going really well, actually. I'm doing it very, very slowly. I just put like $500 in it, and I just started on what amounts to Sunday night, basically. So what, yesterday, I guess. Or no, it might have been Friday. It's just right before the weekend. And yeah, I think it was at 500, and now it's like 523. You know, I mean, it's not like, it's $23. I'm not going to get rich from it. But point is, I've taken several trades, right? Both good and bad. And it's helping me. It kind of one of the reasons why I did it is I just want to hone my skills a little bit on kind of applying what we're doing here. And it's helping me do that because I've taken losing trades, right? And I've taken, you know, obviously more winning trades than losing trades, since in just a couple days it's $23 up, which I understand that's small, but it's helping me understand that like each trade is independent of another.
Yep. And green is green. It's better than going red and you're negative. You could be like, oh, you know, well, it's 480 now. And it's like, okay, well, 528 is better than that.
Absolutely. Okay. So I've taken a few statistics classes in college. And one of the things that people ask, so I'll ask you, is if I flip a coin 50 times and 50 times it lands on heads, what are the chances it lands on heads on the 51st time? So I'll ask you that.
It's 50-50.
It is 50-50. That's right. For whatever reason, that trips college kids up sometimes. But yeah, every flip of a coin is completely independent of the ones before it. And I think this gets into, you know, your whatever system, you know, whatever your trading style is, each trade stands on its own 2 feet. It's got a chance of surviving, you know, it's got a chance of making money and a chance of not making money, but it really doesn't matter if you've had several losers in a row. Now, I will say this isn't a coin flip, and if you've got some sort of system, you know, buy at this point, sell at this point, and you've done 50 losses in a row, you might want to start questioning your system at that point. But if you've back tested and you can clearly see that, you know, you've got some sort of edge here, which is what we're all looking for, right? Some edge that we can win more than we can lose. Then if you've got that and you're confident in it, then the next trade has nothing to do with the trades before it, whether you won or lost. And that's what, you know, that's another reason why I wanted to get back into this crypto trade, Christine, is because I want to get also on a good winning streak, right? I want next week for me to tell you I went from $500 to $600. And for me to tell you I didn't increase my position size because that's what will bite me.
That is, you know, and I was talking to, so when I was tattooing my client, Sam's client was talking about, he used to option trade and he said he's blown up his account a bunch of times. I'm like, yeah, everybody does, like, you know, whatever, market tuition. And he's like, my problem is I would get too confident and I would size up, and then I would keep sizing up. And then at the end, you blow out all the gains that you made.
Absolutely. It's like, by the way, is there more trading talk in your tattoo studio than any other in the country? I feel like there's a lot of trading talk in your studio.
Probably because that's all.
Right. And well, you've got Sam in there too, and I know he's interested in it. So yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's very interesting. You've never done a stock centered tattoo, right? You've never done like a bullish chart or something?
No,
so surprised that I haven't, but I feel like I have gotten DMs from people like, oh, I want to get a ticker on me or like a bullish, whatever chart or whatever it is, something stock related or just trading related, but I have
You
not
know, you haven't
DM'd.
put GME on anybody or anything like that. That would be that would be well, and you see that in Web3 a lot too. If the floor gets to 2 ETH, I'm tattooing my, whatever on me. So yeah, someday, someday.
I've gotten that too, like where people for in the NFT world, they want to get, especially because, a lot of us have NFTs, our favorite NFTs, and they're like, I want to get my NFT on me. So I've gotten that inquiries on that, but I have not yet. I guess they haven't
It's
committed
going
yet.
to happen. It's going to happen. But yeah, so I know you have a lot of it's probably a pretty interesting shop in that sense that there's probably quite a bit of financial discussion going on in your studio more than any others in the entire country, I'm willing to bet. But anyway, yeah, so for your friend that said he had blown out a few accounts from options, yeah, absolutely. Especially those highly leveraged styles like options or highly leveraged derivatives. I think winning sometimes for me is just as detrimental as losing is to me because I feel like I'm being irresponsible by to not double up. I'm printing money over here, Christine. I mean, I don't know why I shouldn't be able to double it and double the output so I can get to my goals faster. Because I know I think, if I've got 500 right now and I'm going to change it to, 1,000, right? Might as well be 2,000.
Still don't know, like I still don't have that like part in me where I'm like, okay, it is now safe to start sizing up. Like I feel like right when I do that, I start messing up.
Here's what, okay, so always here's what I've done, and I think here's what I'm going to do going forward, is always I would say, well, if I double my account, I can then double my position size, right? So if I had $1,000 and I got it up to $2,000, then I would say, okay, then I'm going to double my position size. I'm going to slow that even down going further. And this is where you kind of learn a little bit, which remind me of my learn comment because I'm going to slow that down even more. If I get it from 1,000 to 2,000, I think I may wait going forward, and I may wait till it gets 3 or even 4,000 before I go up past that. And I know that's going to take longer, but I think that's what bites me in the butt every time so far is like I just want to get to I want to go from 1,000 to 10,000, and I want to do it really, really fast. And I think that's the problem. I think if I'll just get I don't know. It will allow me to continue the system to take the drawdown. Every system's going to have some drawdown. When that drawdown happens, I want to do it with my original betting ratio, and not with the drawdown. Because no matter what streak you're on, I know we hear people say like, "It's been 453 days since I had a red day" or something like that. But that's not typical, and it's probably not, anybody listening in here.
Yeah, I actually was listening to someone talk about their trading, and they've blown up their accounts numerous amounts of times because of what we're talking about, just sizing up too confident. And then he said that now he has this sizing, he just sizes appropriately to where he will just try to make $250 a day. He's not trying to do some home runs of 1,000, whatever. Or more, and he does 250 a day, and he's like, and I just get a $5,000, like he's like, it's $5,000, like if I could execute that $5,000 a month, like coming from the options trade, and I guess he sized down to try and like teach people, but he was doing it to where it was like 10,000, but now he wants people to be comfortable with just, hey, just focus on the 250, just make the 250, walk away, make the 250, walk away. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. And I know that if I started doing that every single time, I would start sizing up and just not even
Well,
tell.
I've heard somebody, this is a Web3 person that does crypto trading, and her style is this. She'll start every month with $500, right? And if at the end of the month she's done really well and she gets to $1,500, then she takes out $1,000 and she starts the next month with 500. So at the beginning, it's almost like option trading where you kind of know what your max drawdown could be on each individual trade. She tr trades quite a bit during the month. But at the end of the month, the most she could lose is 500. And whatever she gains over 500, she withdraws and makes that her you know, makes that her money. She and it's not a bad idea. It's not going to be something, you know, I think we all think we're going to trade and it's going to become, you know, our retirement money or something like that. And we can just, you know, day trade for a living in that. So that's not that type of style, but I kind of like that too, of just like, this is the risk. I risk $500. And I think she said most months, almost all months, she ends up doing some sort of withdrawal.
Yeah. And it's almost like paying herself for the time that she's putting in, you know? And yeah, I like that too. And I like the guy that's saying that he just focuses on just, you know, the 250 a day. And I was like, I need to do that instead of I'm over here trying to swing for like, oh, make $1,000 today or make 500. And I'm like, come on, be reasonable. And first perfect, like, you know, be consistent in being able to like, you know, even just do the 250 every day when I'm trading. And then from there, I could, I don't know, I just need to learn to be more consistent and not too confident when I'm
but
doing
the,
well.
The problem is with, you know, making $1,000 a day, especially in options, is it's possible, right? I mean, it's not like you're crazy to make that much in a day. And you probably have had a day that you do that well. But that's the that's what makes it so hard, is it is possible. It's not always likely, but it is possible. And that's what makes it so hard.
Yeah. And it's really, and I think this is why the book keeps talking about like your emotions, is because if we get that in check, then the strategy is just a lot sharper. And then we're sharper in our trading and it's emotionless. Like it's very transactional. It's in and out and it doesn't matter, like whatever it is. And if we lose that trade, we lose that trade. We survive to the next day and we just do it again and we're consistent and we're not full porting and we're not sizing up when we're not supposed to.
I think part of what I, and it's one reason why I started crypto trading again since we last spoke, is, and even with options, I want to slow down. I've been such in a hurry as a trader to try to maximize and grow my account fast. And I really want to get my mental game down. And I think to do that properly, and I'm just speaking for myself, to do that properly, I feel like I just need to slow down and just say, you know what? I'm going to bet small. I'm going to get my rules down, my mental game down. That way, if I do have a big drawdown and I do have kind of a moment that we would call market tuition, it doesn't wipe me out. Instead, I'm able to be like, oh, okay. I think it'll just make me less chaotic in the market. So that's one of my New Year's resolutions here a little bit, is just to slow down in the markets, use what we're learning here in trading in the zone, and just not try to retire by the end of the year, sort of a thing.
Yeah, we need to crawl before, you need to walk before you run, you need to crawl before you walk. And I think we're all very impatient, especially when you know the potential of money that you can make. Everyone wants to be able to just reach those like home runs, but we have to learn to be consistent and, you know, hardwire a strategy, and we need to kind of make it where it's boring so we're not very roller coastery with this whole thing.
That's a great point about the boring. Anytime I have, I think that's why I probably up my position size, is because I get bored. And that's I've got to fix that. I've got to just be okay with being bored and making a little bit of money instead of being like, I need, it's like I'm not going to use that analogy. It's like somebody that's just kind of addicted to drama, that sort of thing. Is they're always starting stuff in relationships and things like that because they like, they like to make up. Let me just say that.
Oh my God. Well, like you're trying to reach an orgasmic point in your trading, and it should just be very boring. So once we reach that boring, like emotionless trading, then we become very robotic about it. And I think that's what we need to do. And you guys, like $50 to $100 even a day in whatever you're trading, that's $1,000 to $2,000 a month. And then once that's super like robotic to you and it's just automatic and you're okay with that and you're okay with being bored in the trading, then we deserve to move up a little bit and then make that boring and then we move up a little bit. But it's the whole thing, like what we're saying, you need to crawl before you walk, walk before you run. We cannot just enter the Olympics, swinging at like what these amazing traders are swinging at, doing $1,000 to $20,000 in a trade. You can't. We can't. We have to just.
Is it Twitter that is part of the problem with that? Right? Is you look through your feed and you do see these people that are doing, you know, amazing returns. Are they real? Are they paper? I don't know, but I'm just saying you see.
Right. Who knows, like, in reality, but it, you know, they're meant to inspire us, right? But I think because we're humans, we're like, well, if they can do it, why can't I do it? And then we get a taste of it, right? Like, I did a Tesla option trade and I made like $6,000 in one trade. And I thought I was like Babe Ruth for like 5 seconds until I lost like 9,000 the next day. But it was like, it, you know, it, we get a little taste of it because everyone's so close to us in this space. And we're like, okay, if they can do it, I could do it. And it's meant to inspire and supposed to be long term, but we're so impatient. We did bring up DeFi Mike here. DeFi Mike.
Yeah, I mean, nobody posts their losses. Most traders don't. And yeah, so comparison is the thief, and definitely in trading, you know, seeing other people's lifestyle, like, you know, this is a space I've been in for a while and all that stuff. So don't get caught comparing yourself. Everybody's journey is different, and $50 a day and 90% of the world is life-changing money. I've been to 30 countries, and except for maybe two or three of them, $50 a day would literally change the whole family's life and the village.
Yeah, that's a good point. And this gets into it's all about perspective as well. But yeah, comparison is definitely the thief of joy here, where you see these people just making, you know, crazy returns. You try to do it yourself, and that's just not where you are. And you're trying to trade as somebody else's style and not your own. And maybe one of the big things you said is people aren't putting, you know, Christine, I don't think I saw you put a Tesla trade for $6,000. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. But then there was the $9,000 loss that you didn't put out, or, you know, maybe you did. I didn't see it.
No, I didn't. I was like, I absolutely didn't put that. I freaking wiped out my account. And it was more of like, I was just beating myself up. So like I was grounding myself and putting myself, I put a dunce hat on myself and whatever. But yeah, you know, DeFi Mike, you make a great point. And, you know, someone had argued to me a while back, I think it was a month or two ago, like, okay, well, you put your gains on, but you're never putting your losses on. And I'm like, yeah, well, I don't want to, because like, I don't want to focus on that. And I try to keep it small, like under 10% and whatever. And I don't want to put the losses on. Like, I don't, why would I? But he had made the point, like, you need to be realistic, though. Like, these people are wanting to see that you also get losses. And I understand that. But I guess it's just a journaling thing in my mind of like, okay, cool, I did this and I could do like better tomorrow and this and that. Not really thinking that other people actually think I don't have losses, because everyone does, you know. But yeah, great point.
And I think just for legal reasons, I don't think people should post their wins or their losses if you guys live in the U.S. especially. I mean, you guys get what I'm saying. Starts with a T.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. And yeah, be careful with just putting out just any information that you put out there. I think in the end, though, as we look to this chapter that was called The Dynamics of Perception, it's going to get into this Wednesday's chapter, which is called The Market's Perspective. So today's was about our own perspective. And I don't know exactly how he's going to get about in chapter 6, but it's called The Market's Perspective. What do you think that is, Christine? Because I'm not sure I know.
I'm not sure. I have no idea. Maybe just our views on the market, or the market's perspective on the trader. I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps. I'm excited for it. I told you last week that I thought chapter 5 was short, but it was not. But chapter 6 is definitely short. Okay, chapter 6 is shorter. And chapter 7 is going to be called The Trader's Edge, Thinking and Probabilities. And I'm really excited for that one. Now, chapter 7 is kind of long, so I don't know if we want to tack that on to 6 this Wednesday or not. But 6 is rather short, so maybe we'll have either a shortened session or an enhanced discussion afterwards. To be able to go into the market's perspective. for Wednesday. Also, a little bit of housekeeping here to anybody that's listening. We need book suggestions. As far as I'm concerned, we're going to continue this book club. So we need book suggestions. So myself or Christine, our DMs are open. Or you can just put it in the little chat bubble up here and tell us what book you want. I said this last week. Don't make it some fictional book that has nothing to do with kind of our audience here. Don't make it Old Yeller or anything like that. I mean, I guess if everybody wants Old Yeller, that's what we'll do. But make it something that would be, I don't know, something that would help us grow a little bit as a person or as a trader. If it is, you know, something that helps us with kind of a personal growth, I think that would be good. Or something that would either entertain or make us learn as traders, whether it be NFT related, you know, options related, anything like that. So, yeah, just slide into our DMs and let us know about what book would probably be the best for that. Anything you want to add to this, Christine, before we wrap this thing up?
No, I think we are good. I was going to reread this chapter because, you know, I like just reading it and not just listening. But since you kind of gave the cliff note and it's very comparable to chapter 5, I might just go off your cliff notes and then just get ready for...
I'm going to beat my chest a little bit and say that was the best cliff notes I've ever given in my life. So I feel like I perfectly summarized the chapter. No, I did tell exactly what it said. So yeah, you can go back and listen to it. It is recorded, a recorded space. So yeah, everybody's got 30 days. But I do invite everyone in here to, I'll create the space for Wednesday shortly after the space. Okay, I'll create it. Christine and I will both share it. Hit the reminder button and join in. Okay, so whenever we first started with chapter one, we had the most people in here. And then it slowly kind of fades down because somebody misses a week and then they think, oh, well, I can't, I'm going to get lost. I feel like this book is one that... Even if it's not like it's a novel where I need to know, you know, all the characters and the butler did it or anything like that. Each chapter kind of stands on its own. So if you miss a chapter, don't freak out about it. Come on in and hear the next chapter after that. And of course, you can always listen later to be able to hear it if you did miss it. But if you did miss a week and you don't feel like you can catch up, don't feel like you can't join back in. Come in here. Listen to chapter 6 next week, and there'll be no harm, no foul. Christine walked away. Of course, I didn't ask anything either. All right, everybody, I'm going to play some smart music here, and we're going to get out of here. We will be back on Wednesday at, let's see, what time? 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central, I think 6:30 Pacific time, so... Until then, I will see you guys come in here, and then we will do this party all over again. We'll do Trading in the Zone Chapter 6 and continue this. Hope everybody has a great week of trading. Hope every day is green for you. But if it is not, remember, each trade is individual from the last trade before this one. So, yeah, don't freak out. Just know that you got to be mentally strong, and your perception of the market has to do with your final results. So remember that. All right, guys. Peace out. Love all of you. See y'all on Wednesday.
I don't give a shit. I've had to pee for like 5 minutes, but I won't leave.